Spain. Hundreds of people, every level from scientists to activists, indigenous leader, are here. Thank you so much to Corinne Nansen and to Tom Goldtu of Indigenous Environmental Network for being here. Corinne with Friends of the Earth International. And in breaking news, Time magazine has named Greta Thunberg Person of the Year. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with our whole team here in Madrid, Spain, at the UN Climate Summit. Yes. Thanks so much for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Personnel Committee meeting has changed for the month of December and will meet Thursday, December 12th, 6 p.m. at
Join KBOO by December 31st and receive free gifts and prizes from the Give Guide. Just click the donate banner on the KBOO app to keep community radio strong and vibrant in Portland and beyond.
When you in the wild, you've a dream that is wild, and they tame you and mold you till one day, behold, your obedient soldiers, commuters, consumers, reality rules, and there's no room for dreamers. They teach you your place in the obstacle race, with a prize that you chase, always just out of reach, and you're urged on by megaphone voices that offer you choices that are not your own. Only listen for the voice that lives inside you, like a songbird in a cage, it waits inside us. Set it free and soaring skywards. Now the sky is filled with voices, hear them sing beside you. If the powers that be in their wisdom decree that you're no longer needed to feed the machine, the wheel turns, you're dismissed. If you dare to resist, there are walls, there are laws to confuse you and bruise you. They'll label you scroungers and wasters and sponges. They'll call you subversives, wretched traitors and worse. If you don't fit the norm, if your wisdom conforms to the rules, then you're out of the game. Only listen for the voice that lives inside you. Like a songbird in a cage, it waits in silence. Find the key to set it free and soaring skywards. Now the sky is filled with voices, hear them sing beside you. The way they've arranged things, you think you can't change things. You're one, you're just you. But whatever they do, don't forget to remember you're a name, not a number. And no one can think for you, dream for you, speak for you. Don't let them bind you down, don't let them grind you down, don't let them mold you till one day, behold, your obedient tools, your commuters, consumers, and reality rules out your dreams. Only listen for the voice that lives inside you. Like a songbird in a cage, it waits in silence. Find the key to set it free and soaring skywards. Now the sky is filled with voices, hear them sing beside you. Now the sky is filled with voices, hear them sing beside you.
And good morning. morning. This is Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO Community Radio. I am your regular host, Paul Rowland. You may have been expecting to hear my regular second Wednesday co-host, Jacqueline Keeler. Unfortunately, she's flying eastward at present to continue her coverage of Indian Country, which we will hopefully hear the results thereof in the upcoming weeks. So I am flying solo today. And wasn't that a wonderful song? Boy, I can't believe I haven't heard that. I've got this four-disc collection of Leon Rosselson, one of my favorite singer-songwriters. And it's just packed full with amazing stuff. Yeah, he's, going on 85 or something this year, or just turned. I interviewed him about a year ago on my early morning folk music show, first and third Thursdays. You can probably find that if you want on our website, kbo.fm, along with all the other archive programs. So I've got a few things on my mind. I'm sure you've got lots of things on your mind. The voice that lives inside you, as Leon Rosselson spoke about, might want to dial 503-231-8187 and join in a community conversation on the air. We don't have too many opportunities to do that in this isolating, segmented, fragmented society, so this is one place you can do it. Monday through Friday from 8 to 9 a.m. here on KBOO. So I live in Montevilla, and you probably heard that just up the street, well, you don't know where I live, but just up the street from where I lived on, on Sunday, the Portland police killed a man. I didn't hear the shots. I was on my bike somewhere, but I certainly heard about it, and it's a place where I do go by, drive by, ride my bike by pretty regularly. And since then, there's been, you know, the cones to divert traffic from the, I guess they left the man in the street for quite a while they did their thing. And Coben S. Henriksen, 51, is the man's name. Anyway, and they've got, piles of some white substance, I guess maybe to soak up the blood, still sitting there within those cones. It's kind of a disquieting thing. It made me think about a lot of things. They interviewed some people who witnessed it, and just the idea, you know, I could have been, like I said, biking to the post office or to the swimming pool. I've never witnessed something like that. I'm sure it doesn't go away soon if you do. I wonder how I would have reacted if I had actually seen it play out. Would I have tried to intervene? Would I, you know, I just blows my mind. But so I want to talk about that. Also, 50 years ago last week, Fred Hampton was gunned down in the house that he shared with a number of other Black Panthers. He was the chairman of the Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party. He was assassinated by the police and FBI. I linked those two together. Obviously, both were killed by law enforcement. It's interesting, the reactions after the, people said he looked homeless. He was apparently maybe wearing a blanket around his shoulders. You know, people who are having a really rough time, you know, don't have a place to live, don't have, you know, easy changes of clothes, sometimes resort to wrapping a blanket around their shoulders against the cold. He was walking in the street, stopping traffic. So, you know, he was an inconvenience. He was impeding the orderly flow of traffic. And and life in the society, I guess. And so, yeah, I wasn't there. I've been piecing it together from reports that I've read about. It's, you know, as these things always go, you do tend to hear more and more as time goes on. So they say he had a knife. They say he was coming at the police. There's differing accounts over who shot first. Apparently there was a police who had a gun that had supposedly foam-tipped projectiles, which the police call in a very ambiguous way less than lethal. But one eyewitness that I read about said that he only heard the rifle, live ammunition rifle, go off, three shots. Okay, so there's a lot to unpack as these things happen. One of them is the idea of a perceived threat that the police have. Obviously, Fred Hampton was very much a perceived threat, very much of a real threat to the smooth functioning of the capitalist system. He was gunned down in his sleep 50 years ago. This man was some kind of apparently was perceived as a threat by the police. As I said, they say he had a knife. Okay, so every time someone who has a knife, who they say he has a knife, gets gunned down by the police, it makes me wonder, because the police do get let off regularly, almost always, when they say that they felt a threat. That's a legitimate exculpatory justification for police shootings. So, but I always wonder though, okay, so if I have a gun and someone's coming at me with a knife, I don't know, it just seems like how close does the person have to get before you actually feel a real threat? I mean, okay, and they've got nightsticks. Nightsticks are what? A foot and a half long? A knife is usually, you know, just a few inches. I don't know. Am I being unreasonable here? I just, when someone's got a knife, it just seems like there are so many other ways of handling the person. I don't know. I started to think weird thoughts, you know, like you see in the movies, you know, they throwing a net over someone, like a heavy net. I mean, is that kind of just weird? Or, you know, they have these tasers. You know, they shoot large mammals, stampeding mammals even, like elephants, with dart guns. That seemed to be quite effective. I mean, that's a really, from a civil rights standpoint, it does seem kind of grotesque to shoot a human being with a dart gun. But, you know, when it's between killing someone and letting them live another day and possibly, you know, emerge from whatever crisis they're in that seemingly led them to be in the situation that they found themselves in. Okay, so these are some of my thoughts. At the same time, as you heard on Amy Goodman, and probably elsewhere if you're paying attention, there's these massive, just apocalyptic wildfires burning in Australia. We've seen apocalyptic wildfires here in California and elsewhere. There's a massive drought happening in southern and eastern Africa and the Horn of Africa. Millions of people are facing serious water shortages, food shortages. The Antarctic, the Greenland ice sheet is now melting at, what, 5-7 times the previously measured rate. Things are going pretty seriously wrong on the planet, and we don't seem to know what to do about it. Or maybe we do know what to do about it. There just doesn't seem to be much power in our hands. Okay, so why focus on things like a man being killed by the police here in Portland? Well, for one thing, this is our community, and theoretically we do have more control, perhaps we say, you know, we now have at least two people on the city council that are very progressive on a lot of these issues. Joanne Hardesty, who has a show here on KBOO, has been a fierce critic of the police and a very principled, dedicated, consistent person who works within the system in a, you know, respectful way, but is very, 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 very committed to justice and to seeing that these kind of wrongs, I see this as a wrong, this man being killed. And Chloe Udaly is pretty good on a lot of these issues. And so there's a city council now that could make some serious changes. I know the contract for the Portland police is coming up for renewal next year, I believe. So a lot of these issues about, you know, what kind of, how much leeway police officers have to utilize non-lethal and non-lethal force to police demonstrations in a violent way. A lot of these things can be regulated through the Portland Police Union contract. So anyway, there's lots of things we can do, but just the climate of fear and powerlessness that events like this can have on us. I mean, just the numbing effect of violence at all levels. So let's do something about this. Let's stop these kind of police killings. So, okay, if you have a different take on what happened, please give me a call. I don't have all the information. I'm just saying that I can't see a man who's wandering in the street, interrupting traffic, and within, I think they said, less than a minute of the police arriving. This is so common that this happens, less than a minute, sometimes less than 20 seconds, 10 seconds. A man is lying dead on the, a person is lying dead on the ground, which is what happened once again here in Southeast Portland. I just happen to be thinking about this, I guess, a lot more. Proximity, you know, has a big impact, plays a big factor in our minds and our lives. And the fact that this was just a few blocks from my house, and I had to, as I said, bike by and see the, on the street, the markings, the remainders of what had happened there. And yeah, I could read some of this article just to be a little clearer. 503-231-8187, that's the number. Okay, so let me just read a little bit so you get a little clearer. Okay, so this guy said he was a Coben Henriksen, says a man who has experienced severe mental illness, court records show. In 2014, Clackamas County Court sent Henriksen to the Oregon State Hospital for trial fitness treatment after finding that he was mentally unfit to aid and assist in his own defense in a misdemeanor theft case, showing that Henriksen suffered some form of severe mental illness at the time. Whatever exactly that means is hard to know. The charges were eventually dismissed. Dispatch records and witness accounts helped pull the shooting into clear focus, depicting a fatal encounter unfolding seconds after two officers' initial contact with Henriksen. On Monday, police named Justin Raphael as the officer who fired the fatal shots. He's been with Portland Police for 7 years. Officer Daniel Leonard, an 11-year veteran with the agency, fired less lethal rounds. Both are on paid administrative leave while Portland Police conduct an internal review and the Multnomah County District Attorney investigates the shooting. There's another point. There's people running for district attorney now. This is something that's going on around the country. There's been two very, very progressive, even in some ways radical, district attorneys who've been elected. It's an elected position in Philadelphia and in San Francisco. It seems to be a trend. People are seeing that as yet another avenue for taking back power, a really important one, because a district attorney has so much influence and say over who gets investigated, how they get investigated, how the investigative gets framed, what kind of charges are brought, all sorts of things. So anyway, one thing to pay attention to, the Multnomah County District Attorney race coming up. Police received a call at 1:40 p.m. Sunday reporting suspicious circumstances involving a weapon, according to their news release. Dispatch call recordings show that two callers reported that a man, presumably Hendrickson, was standing in the middle of the road near Southeast 103rd Drive and Stark Street, pointing a knife at passing cars. Pointing a knife. I mean, a lot of threat that is. Maybe they'll scratch their car. I mean, I don't mean to make light. If I was in a car, I would be very disconcerted, of course. I'm not making light, but, you know, let's put things in some context and perspective here. You know, if that's the way the initial, you know, situation got framed, that a man was threatening with a knife, you know, that frames the police officer's response. Okay, Sergeant Kevin Allen said Monday he could not confirm whether Hendrickson was armed with a knife or other weapon. Well, okay. Portland police policy on use of force directs officers to, quote, avoid or minimize force used on people in a behavioral or mental health crisis and people with mental illness. We've been through this so many times before. They've been, you know, they're in a Justice Department mandated protocol for dealing with their issues on dealing with people in a mental health crisis, you know, and officers should direct those people to services where possible, it says. Leonard and Raphael respond to the scene. Police said Leonard was armed with a less lethal 40-millimeter launcher that shoots foam-tipped projectiles. Raphael carried a rifle, according to witness accounts and dispatch calls. According to dispatch call recordings, by the way, I'm reading from the Oregonian Oregon Live from Monday, December 10th. Looks like we got a call. Let me just finish a couple more paragraphs here. So just to set the scene, and then I'll continue. Okay, about 6.5 minutes after the initial call. Okay, wait. According to dispatch call, the officers met at Southeast 106th Avenue and Southeast Cherry Blossom Drive before approaching Hendrickson just a few blocks from where he was blocking traffic. Witnesses told the Oregonian that two police vehicles drove up to the man in close succession. About 6.5 minutes after the initial call to police, officers appear to make contact with Hendrickson, according to the dispatch recordings. Records show that 13 seconds later, dispatch called for a medical response, and an officer's voice can be heard saying, "Officers are okay. Suspect is down." Robert Vervloot, 58, was waiting for his drink at Starbucks when he witnessed police fatally shoot Hendrickson. Vervloot, a longtime Portland resident, had just finished shopping at a nearby Fred Meyer and had stopped to grab a hot eggnog drink on his way home. His girlfriend was waiting in their car parked in the lot. It was about 1:40 p.m. That's when Vervloot heard the honking, loud and piercing. Across from the coffee shop, he saw a man standing in front of an 18-wheeler truck that was attempting to drive north on Southeast 103rd Drive. The driver rolled down a window and said something to a man, who then walked slowly into the next lane of traffic towards Starbucks. The man was about two or three car lengths from the intersection with Stark, he said. Vervloot watched as a man casually walked, hands at his side, across the street, ignoring the vehicles coming toward him. He didn't see the man carrying a weapon or knife, or see him acting aggressively toward the vehicles, he said. This man was, quote, "This man was walking. He didn't look threatening in any way, shape, or form. He was almost in a zombie-like state. There was no aggression." Another car, this time a smaller white car, screeched to a halt to avoid hitting Hendrickson. Obviously, this is a, you know, this is a situation. You don't want people to crash to avoid him. We don't want him to get hit. Obviously, something needs to be done to deal with the situation. True. Okay, he continues. That's my interjection. Seconds after that, the first police car arrives. Vervloot said it rolled in with the flow of traffic traveling north on 103rd. A police SUV arrived from the same direction a few seconds later. The SUV caught Vervloot's attention. An officer opened the driver's side door, stood, and propped what looked like an AR-15-style rifle on the door. The man had made his way onto the sidewalk alongside the Starbucks parking lot and was standing with his hand still at his sides. The officer pointed his rifle in the man's direction and the direction of Starbucks. Vervloot said, "My brain was drawing the bead line of where the bullet could travel if they missed." The man walked zombie-like toward the two cops. Vervloot didn't hear any words exchanged between the officers and the man. He just heard himself yell, "No, this is not going to happen." But the officer with the rifle fired shots. Vervloot heard two, and the man fell. All right. It's starting to be distressing to me just reading that. And we got a caller. So let's go to our first caller. Go ahead. You are on the air. Please identify yourself. Thank you.
Hi, Paul. This is Jack. Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Hi. This sounds like the usual sort of encounter, but I actually happen to be an armed citizen, as the jargon goes, and I've been through a significant amount of firearms training, most of which involved defining what is self-defense. So this is for a citizen, let alone for a policeman who can get away with a lot more stuff. Credible distance that an assailant becomes a credible threat justifying self-defense, 75 feet. The basic paradigm is they, you know, someone tested it, I guess, and decided that, you know, you can cover in 5-6 seconds 75 feet if you're striding pretty well. Okay? So, you know, all these questions you bring up, yeah, they have answers, and most of them the cops were probably within parameters, especially considering that this is a stand your ground state, right? All that part about you just have to feel threatened, we're like Florida now, okay? Once the knife comes out, if they're anywhere within striking distance of the cop, it's over with, okay? Once you present a weapon, a deadly weapon, you have the... you as a citizen would have the right to respond with deadly force. And if we want to stop this stuff, the real root of it is this guy needs to be in a hospital room somewhere.
So wait a second, are you yourself justifying the police's behavior then?
No, I'm not justifying anybody's behavior. I'm telling you what the law says. Your opinion of it, when it gets to the grand jury, it ain't going to matter what my opinion of it or your opinion of it is. It's going to matter what, A, the law says, and B, what the district attorney
Well, the law says a lot of things. It doesn't make it right.
No, I'm not talking about right.
Well, I'm talking
right,
about
right. Is it going to matter? Yeah, but again, if you want to stop this kind of encounter, then this guy needs to get the treatment that he needs, and the police need to get the training that they need to handle someone like this without immediately going to gun. And the only thing they kind of understand, they don't get a whole lot of training.
Right. I hear all that you're saying. I'm still questioning the legitimacy of this of the justification, the legal justification. That's what I'm questioning. You say someone can cover 75 feet in 5 or 6 steps.
That's what the law says, okay? If you, as an ordinary person, have used deadly force against another person and caused their death, and you're trying to justify self-defense, that's what they say the credible distance for an assailant is. Seems like a pretty long way to me, but my opinion doesn't really matter. As far as how quick, you know, once the knife comes out, and probably in this case, it's going to be much like the one that happened a couple of years ago here in Southeast where I live, where our local merc, who was an armed citizen, shot a guy out by the dumpster that threatened him, and that he felt threatened by. Mainly, I think the guy was just an annoyance and had been for a long time. They had a history. But when it got in front of the grand jury, once they can say that the guy had a weapon and they can prove that, then it changes the whole parameter of what is justifiable use of force.
Right. I guess what I'm saying is that this is the problem. There's so many interlocking problems. I guess I take issue with your solution to some extent. I hear what you're saying. You're very reasonable, and it's an important conversation to have. I think we need to get a little deeper into it. So the problem is this kind of one size fits all. So the witness was saying this guy was moving very zombie-like. So the idea that he could actually, so theoretically he could, I guess if somebody gave him a shot of, you know, amphetamines, maybe he would start to move really fast. But it sounds like the actual situation was very different than the mere possibility is not enough, so that you have to deal with the context. So I guess police training needs to deal with the context that they find themselves in, and not just applying. See, once you've got a gun and you can take someone down, it's so easy to resort to that as a quick solution. But that's what we're trying to get away from. We're trying to get away from, you know, because people have all kinds of biases. Their perceived threat, sure, they can justify it by perceived threat, but their perceived threat is conditioned, as has been demonstrated by numerous studies, by their own unconscious biases. Often has to do with race, might have to do with, you know, what's perceived mental illness, that somebody is weird or different. You know, there's a lot of factors. And so yeah, those are problems that people are able to use something that can inflict deadly force within split second in a situation that is unfolding perhaps in a much different way than, you know, than a say on a battlefield, maybe we dumped that. So there's going to be a.
I apologize. We need different police, and we need a society that does not throw this man away on the street as an economic casualty. And when he goes nuts from it, doesn't have a place for him to be treated.
Yeah, no, totally.
As long as you have people like this interacting with police on the street, you know, I mean, being right. I believe in all that good right stuff too, but I'm also a realist, and you know what? Police are dangerous in this country. They've always been dangerous in this country. Their job is to keep poor people down, and their attitude, and in some ways, I don't know, what would you do if it was your job, is I'm going home tonight. And if there's any kind of a violent encounter, you're the one who's going to have a funeral. And he got in their way, and the inevitable happened, and I'm sorry for him.
All right, well,
we need to change it on a societal level. We need to change this society if we're going to stop this kind of stuff from happening. As far as stopgap measures, well, you know, these guys need to, if we could spend the money, which is probably the root of the problem of why it doesn't happen, okay, if these guys really were trained to deal with this kind of assailant, to neutralize him without going to gun and shooting him, then, you know, and have the tools, you know, there's armor out there that will prevent a stab.
Right.
Like you point out.
Listen,
you know,
yeah.
Why not get a couple of cops hurting someplace and use the taunts to take him down?
No, exactly. If they already heard he had a knife, and that's the situation that they think they're dealing with, they should go in there again. It's like instead of a one size fits all, it's like suss the situation out. And again, it's like, why did it just take so little time? I mean, what was the urgency in that particular situation? You know, so yeah, there's a lot of questions. Listen.
Once a cop in front of him sees a knife come out, it's all over.
Yeah.
And I would suggest this to you. Believe me, I'm not sticking up for the police, man. I like the police probably less than you have, and I've spent a fair amount of my life out in the streets of Portland, Oregon, facing off on the line across from it.
Uh-huh.
But, again, I'm a pragmatist. If you stick your hand in the blender, you're going to lose your fingers. If you confront police in a violent way on the street, you're probably going to lose.
Well, listen. We got to. I would like to actually carry on this conversation for a while longer, because this has got a lot of good stuff to say. But we have two other callers all of a sudden on the line. I want to respect and
one final parting shot to you about this.
Uh huh.
If you feel like discounting your knife is a threat, how long did it take from the time Jeremy Christian produced a blade to the time the two of our comrades were laying on the floor dead?
Well, that was also in a pack. Max train, you know, it's context is everything. So that's a valid point, but it's the situation was extremely different. So, but I hear what you're saying. Okay. Well, thank you very much for calling. That was good.
Thank you, man.
All right. Wow. So let's just, I could have said more stuff. Let's go to our next caller. Go ahead. Identify yourself and say what you got to say.
Well, it's Mike. Am I on or is somebody else on?
Yeah, it's you.
Okay. Well, first off, I just have one simple thing I'd like to say about this whole thing, and everybody, I would like you to listen carefully. You have to ask yourself, if you're a police officer, if you're a man on the street or whatever, what were we put here on this planet to do as individuals? What were we put here to do?
Okay. I'm not sure that, I'm not sure that's relevant, because they're in the situation of they're a police officer, not just a regular human being. So I'm not sure they're necessarily thinking about what their role on the planet is. They're thinking of what their role as a police officer with high-powered weaponry at their disposal.
Well, all right. I would really, I know you're doing good things. I think you know what you were put here on this planet to do. And I think I know, I've known lots of police. I've been really lucky. And 99% of them are good people. They're good folks. They're just, they're not cops. They're human beings. They went to the military. They think they've done everything right. And maybe they have. They probably have. But at the end of the day, if everybody would just stop for a minute and ask themselves, I know they want to go home to their wives and kids and stuff. I get that. But, you know, okay. I just want to put that out there.
Okay, well, thank
everybody
you.
Everybody needs... Okay, thank you.
All right. I mean, okay, yeah, sure. I just... To me, that just is kind of vague. It's like, again, I don't think it gets to the...
No, it is not vague. What is the reason for our existence on an individual?
They've got a few seconds to make a decision. Obviously, they're not thinking about what they're put on the planet to do. They're thinking that there's a man with a knife. They're thinking that, I don't know what they're thinking. I have no idea exactly what he's thinking. But I guarantee you, the police training is not going to insert in their training. Before you do anything, you think about what you're put on the planet. I hate to be kind of ruthless about this, but that's just the way it is. Okay, I got to let you go. We got other callers. Thank you for calling.
Okay, did he really have a knife? I thought his hands were at his side.
Well, that's a question. That's a valid question. They said he did. Now the police say they can't absolutely confirm it. The one witness said he didn't actually see anything. So yeah, hopefully this will come out. And there were a lot of witnesses. They actually, they put a whole bunch of witnesses on a metro bus. I think it was the 20, one of my buses. Poor people who were on the metro were waylaid there for a while because of this happened. And they interviewed a lot of people. I think it's interesting that Mayor Wheeler and Chief Outlaw actually showed up fairly soon after it happened. That was unusual. I wonder what that was all about. But anyway, hey, I got to let you go. We got some more callers. Thank you very much for calling.
You bet. You do a good job. Good show.
All right. Let's go to our next caller.
Yeah, this is Ross.
Hi, Ross.
Hey, yeah, I appreciate the last caller and one before very much. Now the last is what are we here to live for? Well, the thing is that at least focuses on the idea of norms and values, and police have norms of conduct and professionalism that they are supposed to follow, and that should be through training. It should guide them. Now we're hearing a lot of things about this particular event. And immediately after the event, of course, we get angry and so forth. But it seems to me the very proper thing is would be to make sure that a committee is gathered to review all the facts that
can be obtained. What committee are you talking about?
Well, it could be a citizen committee.
What do you mean it could be? This is happening now, and whatever is going to happen around this is going to be with whatever structural processes and institutional guidelines are actually in place. So there's going to be an internal review. There used to be I forget the name of it, one kind of a citizens review some kind of review board that actually got dissolved. There's another one. I
hear
right. So
I
anyways,
hear what you're saying, but the thing is that some review has to try to learn how were the protocols violated, or do the protocols need to be changed? That was bad and inappropriate police behavior. I think everybody will agree. Police will agree. Yesterday, I heard an interview with Daryl Turner, the police guy, And he says that he's opposed to having these this alternative way of having mental health people come to the state. He'd rather have the police, because he says police are trained. They maintain that police are trained. Well, they have to at least review that training. And the other thing is, this is very hard to do at this moment, but we have to understand that this is very abnormal police behavior that we saw. It's wrong, and we have to somehow or other.
Well, unfortunately, it doesn't seem to be that abnormal.
Respect good police behavior, and insist on it. I would like it to improve the police in such a way so that everybody who graduates from high school can envision becoming a policeman, that it should be a dignified and a position where you can exercise your discipline and follow what you have to do, because it put yourself in harm's way.
Well, there's also going to be pie in the sky when we die too.
It is not pie in the sky. That's what we fight for. We're not fighting to make policemen into devils. We are fighting to change those police, so we shouldn't demonize them. Of course, these people are doing something really bad, but we do not have to demonize
them. I'm not demonizing anybody. I was just describing the situation that happened. That's all I was doing.
You did, and you did a good job. But I would challenge, because I've made this challenge before, I would challenge you to open up to a program someday inviting people to call in to talk about their positive experiences with police. Everybody's had positive experiences with police, but we don't talk about...
Okay, well, there's a bigger issue. I mean, I have issue with the institution of the police itself, because as the first caller said, the police are here basically to enforce social order. We have a corrupt social order. It's been corrupt and unjust from the very beginning of this country. The police grew out of the militias and the people who chased down runaway slaves. That's what, and the people who policed the emerging cities. They had to crack down on the open air commerce because it was threatening the property class's control of commercial activity. That's what the police came out of. That's what the institution of the police is problematic from the very beginning in this country. So, you know, it's not. Let's get away from this idea of. We're talking about that's one level. If you really want to talk about the police, let's talk about it on that level. I'm talking right now.
That's theoretical. That's idealistic.
It's real. It's history.
Reality is what police do and who they are. They're human beings.
No, I'm talking about history. I'm talking about the role of police in our society.
The role is an artificial construct, and you're committing the gross error.
It is an artificial construct. Maybe we should just get rid of it.
You know. Listen, I was talking. He was criticizing the FBI. He wanted to get away. Do away with the FBI. That's insane.
Well, it's interesting. You can criticize the FBI from various vantage points. I mean, the FBI also killed Fred Hampton, as I was also talking about.
Oh God,
who was killed 50 years ago.
That?
Right.
That's why we fight a revolution so the FBI don't kill Fred Hampton.
All right.
He's not going to do
it. All right.
With
fair
the
enough.
FBI.
Okay.
Lunacy.
Well, as long as we're on the same page in terms of wanting a revolution. All right. Thank you very much for calling.
Okay.
We got other callers. Okay. Well, we're all of a sudden we've got less than 20 minutes left. This is a Wednesday talk radio. We've been talking about a very hot button issue. Another man killed by the Portland police. I know I've sort of come out and made my decision based upon press reports, and we should wait till all the things come out. And you know, the whole issue that was brought up about the police, Daryl Turner, the head of the Portland Police Union, wanting to not have these street teams. I forget the name that's been proposed to have first responders responding to mental health people in mental health crisis instead of the police turning to non-police, turning to professional mental health professionals and maybe an EMT. I'm not sure. I don't have that information right in front of me. And the Portland Police Bureau has come out against that. You know, and the reason is because it threatens their territory. It threatens their control, threatens their power, is my belief. You know, And the Portland police can do good. Actually, there's another story from just two days before where the Portland police went to the Unity Center where they had kicked somebody out, a person who had gone there in serious crisis, and they'd put him out on the streets and then called the cops on him. This is the Unity Center, which is the psychiatric hospital, which was basically planned, designed, funded to deal with people in mental health crisis, so they didn't have mental health crisis in public and put themselves and others at risk, theoretically. That's what it's for, the Unity, there in inner northeast Portland. And there's somebody who went there, and he got kicked out, and they called the cops, and the cops rightly said, hey, it's like, this is not our job, you know, and the security guard was trying to get him to arrest him, and I don't know, what a messy situation. The cops actually did the right thing in that situation. So yes, sometimes, for sure. And, you know, and it's an unenviable job. I'm not saying, you know, I'd hate to be a police officer. It's a terrible, I think it's a terrible, you know, they get the, you know, the weight, so much of the weight of the society's problems put on their shoulders, and it shouldn't be on them. Yeah, because we have a vicious capitalist system which doesn't, you know, actually help people. It actually injures us all continually, doesn't allow the space and time and money to actually solve the problems that it creates. And yeah, so, okay, we need to change the capitalist system. In the meantime, we've got, you know, these immediate day-to-day problems, and we've got, you know, climate change, which is unraveling our climatic system as we speak. And it's all in all a dreary situation. But here we are in Portland, and let's try to stop the police from killing people. And again, so yeah, this it's a complex situation. These police did the right thing at the Unity Center a few days ago, where they actually basically made them take the guy back in, essentially. Or they shamed the psychiatrist in charge, whoever, and they took the guy back in. I don't know what happened to him, you know. Anyway, so yeah, it's a complex situation. But we got other callers. Go ahead, caller. You are on the air.
Yes, it is complex. Hey, Paul, this is Sean.
Hi, Sean.
How are you?
I'm all right. I'm all worked up now.
I thought the last phone call was going to get way, way out there. So first off, I want to recommend a great book, and it's also the book is Punishment Without Crime, and the author, who has been a prosecutor, writing about the gigantic growth of the misdemeanor punishment system, and her name is Alexandra Patakoff, Patakoff. And there was a great interview with her through Street Roots, so anybody can go online and find that, search on their website. Great book about that. So, but I know we're talking about mental illness, but, you know, it has a lot to do with, because they get caught up in that massive misdemeanor thing.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I don't know. I know one of the callers had mentioned, I think the last caller had mentioned Daryl Turner, and I just happened to, I kind of came in late on this, but I happened to catch that interview where they were talking about, you know, Portland is going to take up, based upon the CAHOOTS program in Eugene, which has worked great for them. And they've been doing this for quite a while. And that was on OPB yesterday. I forget the program, but the one that's on at noon. And, you know, the same thing. I find it extremely...
Think out loud.
Yeah, think out loud. And, you know, they had Daryl Turner, head of the police union, and the fella from the firefighting union, and then a gal representing Joanne Hardesty and the new program. And I forget the title in Portland, but... It's just more than ironic, ridiculous, whatever, that, you know, here, of course, the unions are fighting to remain involved in this, because to me, I just see it strictly more as not a virtuous but an economic thing for them, you know.
Exactly.
You know, their jobs, they abuse the overtime system. I mean, that's been well known in unions for a long time, especially within the police union. So I don't buy much. And the irony of it is, you know, after all these years, and CAHOOTS has been in place for a long time and has worked very well for them, and many times, of course, leaving the police out of it and using advocates, which helps tone these kind of situations down, that don't end up being murders and shootings and so forth. So I just find it incredibly ironic that here's the police union, of course, in here fighting to remain involved and saying that they, in a way, do as good, if not a better job, and they need to be involved. But why, after all these years, has it gotten to this point? Because they haven't been able to do the job correctly. And I always come back to the James Chassis incident, you know. And one of the things that didn't come up in that conversation is how just the physical showing up of the police is so threatening and intimidating to people who are homeless. Let's just, we're just keep it to the situation.
Right, maybe, yeah, that's an excellent point. You know,
they never brought that up.
Yeah.
Right? It heightens it immediately. You know, it's not like they don't know that.
It's like sometimes red flag in front of a bull. I mean, who's to say that if somebody different had shown up and acted differently, the man would not have actually run at them with a knife.
Which is why Cahoots was created, right, and why it works, because they have actual people who have been involved in the homeless community. Let's say you bring a couple people from Sisters of the Road into it. You bring people from Street Roots who go on this, and they come in, and maybe they even know them, right? But they know what to do. They're used to being around these people. The police are not there. Well, I just got to go back. Look, one of the things I forgot about, the police are a very conservative unit across the board. They're very conservative. And people forget, most of these guys that get hired in police departments across the nation, they come straight out of the military. There is a huge incentive and a program between the military and the police forces that if you go into the police force, you get all these benefits, and it's a conveyor belt. And so a lot of these guys that come in are yahoos. I'm not saying they're all, but they join the police force because, you know, everybody's attracted to a certain institution or job for a certain reason based upon who they are. It's authoritarian. They love the job that they feel, and I don't care. They feel like they know they are above the law. And they also know in situations like this, how many times they come up, somebody gets shot, and they come up with the excuse, the guy had a weapon. We can't necessarily prove it, but he had a weapon, but we planted it there, we said it was there, and that's enough justification to let us off. I mean, just the other day, and it was on KLCC, but I wasn't quite clear if it was they were talking about Eugene or Portland or overall, but it was somebody who came out and said that they had shown that the police were not guilty of racial profiling. You know, I mean, these kinds of things, what's ultimately about? It's about protecting the police from really being found guilty for things like this over and over and over. Why? Because the police are the let's say Portland, just Portland alone. They are the face of the city.
Yeah, we're running out of time. We've got a few other callers.
I'll just make quick. So if they find themselves guilty, then you're finding the system guilty, and they can't have that.
Excellent point. That's actually where I wanted to get to with this whole program today. Thank you so much for saying that. These people are threats to the system, you know, for whether it's Fred Hampton or a homeless person who demonstrates the absolute failures of our society, the absolute failures of our society. So easier to eliminate the reminder. And then, as you say, yeah, they can't actually acknowledge that their role and their guilt. It's true. So thank you very much for that. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
I got just a few minutes left. There's a few points I kind of wanted to make. We didn't get to talk much about Fred Hampton. The Rainbow Coalition of Revolutionary Solidarity was the name of the organization that Fred Hampton organized in the late 60s, founded in Chicago, along with William Preacherman Fesperman of the Young Patriots Organization, which were almost all Appalachian transplants from the coal fields, the dislocations from the devastations of that, and a lot of the failed rebellions against the power of big coal in Appalachia. Anyway, and Jose Chacha Jimenez of the Young Lords, the Chicano, Puerto Rican largely, I believe, organization, along with the Black Panthers. It was the first of several 20th century black-led organizations to use the Rainbow Coalition concept. Of course, people know of Jesse Jackson, but this was, you know, the original one, and it was, you know, based upon an alliance of revolutionaries from different backgrounds and identities. So that's what we need, is a new Rainbow Coalition based upon, as Fred Hampton said so eloquently in the documentary, I can't remember the name of it, based upon political education, which is something to talk about. What is political education, and how, and who gets to decide what political education is? All right, so that's a bunch of stuff, but we have some other callers still. We have one more caller waiting on the line before we wrap up. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hello?
Yeah.
Me?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. You know, the basic thing, in my opinion, about this is simple. There is training. There are non-lethal methods to subdue people. Jiu-jitsu is the overall category for all of this. There's several versions of it. You can find demonstrations online of police being trained to use it. It is being done here, but slowly, slowly coming on. If anybody's aware, in Japan, for example, the police do not carry weapons. Now, there are not a lot of weapons in Japan to begin with, so, but nevertheless, they don't use lethal force to subdue people when they feel they need to. And it can be done. It's non-lethal. They have to get close to them, basically lock them down, hold them to the ground, and pin them. But it works, okay? And I don't understand why the police here aren't universally trained in those methods.
Well, it might have something to do with American culture to begin with.
Well, maybe, but it is being done in some places. If anyone's interested, you can just, you know, Google it up, jiu-jitsu police training, and there's a lot of videos showing this training, and there are some real time things out there, but it's sometimes it's questionable whether it's a setup or it's a real or not. But nevertheless, it is available, and I think that if you know, changing the whole police culture and the whole society takes a long time, but this is something that could be done very quickly.
Uh-huh. Well, there has to be the kind of people power, political pressure exerted on the police, and there has to be, I think, other unions calling out the police union. Why are these police unions these strange exceptions that are able to use their own...
That's a meta debate, you know?
Well, it's an important debate. No, I think that's...
The actual techniques that are being employed.
Yeah, but I'm saying to make any changes in the police requires political and popular pressure to be brought to bear, and that's the reality of the situation. We can't just, you know, magically wave our wand and make it happen. We have to force it to happen. So I'm suggesting ways to make it to happen. But thank you for calling. I appreciate that. On a totally unrelated note, here's something that appeared on my Facebook screen. The blood of poor Americans is now a leading export, bigger than corn or soy. Huh, maybe we're going to export it to China. America is one of the only developed countries in the world that pays people to donate blood. Much of it sold abroad. 70% of the world's plasma is of U.S. origin. And as commercial blood donations have soared, blood now accounts for 2% of the country's exports. I wonder if that could be part of our trade deal. More than corn or soya. There's more growth ahead for blood products, expected to grow radiantly, according to an analyst who was cheering 13% growth between 2016 and 17. One study found that the typical blood seller derives a third of their income from selling blood. Princeton's Catherine Eden called the commercial blood industry the lifeblood of the $2-a-day poor. That's the United States of America for you. Well, we're plumb out of time here at Wednesday Talk Radio. Glad I could be with you. Jacqueline Keeler, I'm not sure if she'll be back before the second Wednesday of the month. We might have her back, and so she can make up this program. She's traveling at present. I'm Paul Rowland. Thanks so much for staying tuned to Talk Radio here on KBOO.
bear is wagging his finger. Poor Box is scratching his head. They ought to be shooting the bankers, but they're giving them money instead. The pleb should be storming the ramparts and whetting the guillotine's blade, singing capitalism's in crisis. So where are the barricades? Why don't they close down the city and throw all the gamblers in jail? But they're still making money, make money, as they slice up the future for sale. And Sir Numbskull still hugging his bonus. Lord Grab has made off with the loot, and the slick city traders, the corporate raiders, freebooters and fraudsters, hedge fund speculators, the stock market scammers, brain dead regulators, why aren't they all getting the boot?
Have you ever wondered how a radio station works? Find out by joining KABU's engineering committee. Or, do you have a radio, electrical, or audio engineering background and are looking for a good way to use those skills for good? Join KABU's engineering committee. KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, unless otherwise noted. The next engineering committee will meet Thursday, December 12th at 7 p.m.
Thank you, baby. I just wanna take a little time out. Do you? Thank you, baby.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you for contributing to KABU's membership.